You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
702 and Cape Talk.
Family Matters.
19 minutes after 11 o'clock. For the rest of this hour, we're going to be focusing on the psychology of toxic masculinity and try not to watch too much what's going on at the Australian Open. I am a nervous supporter of Serena Williams, and it's into the third set. I prefer it when she loses the first, because then she takes momentum into the third one. As it happens, she lost the second set, and I hope that she's able to just hold on, avenge the loss of her sister in the previous round to Halep, but also make sure that she marches toward that record, equaling Margaret Court's. So I'm multitasking here, and safely so, because we have an excellent guest. Quite frankly, I can go have coffee, watch the tennis, and you'll be in safe hands, because Hayden Nipps is here with us, clinical psychologist. How's it, Hayden?
Very good, and you? Thank you for that.
Nervous, but good. Not because of you.
Indeed.
Because of what's happening there to my right. Yes. I shall not look. Are you well?
Yes, very good. I hope you're well as well.
I am. There are some words that we bandy about, those of us who are fluent in them. Mm. And maybe before we talk about the psychology, which is really where we want to get to, we better explain what we mean by masculinity and toxic masculinity. They are words that have become all the rage. Yes. As we deal with gender inequality the world over and patriarchy. Mm. But many people are now too scared because they feel it's too late to put up their hand and say, but like, define that for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, even before we dive into that, I want to rewind quickly and just touch on again, group dynamics. The reason for this, for those listeners that have heard me before on this station, and I have spoken about it before, but I do want to re-highlight it. It's because it carries such paramount importance to the discussion at hand. To dismiss it out of hand will be to do a disservice. So in brief, essentially, when humans, all of us, when people are involved in certain things in our lives, we form groups for various reasons. Probably the most common reason is for security and defense. When we are talking about groups, in this instance, one of the groups that's ready on the table is males. What we find when all of us form into a group, over time, the research has shown us, is that our perception of other group members begins to skew, and we see similarities, sometimes more than what are present, and our perception of any out-group members start to skew. So people that are pushing against the group, we start to believe and see as different. Also on top of that, and this mechanism, let me just highlight, this mechanism is exceptionally strong. I'm laying out the clinical definition or the description of it, but the reality is that this mechanism essentially is behind some of the largest atrocities in the world.
That's right.
World War II will be based on this kind of psychology. The Rwandan genocide, apartheid, in fact, will be based on this psychology. So I want to highlight that because I want to emphasize the delicate nature through which one should approach a group discussion or a discussion about a group. To ignore this mechanism, really the result will just be that people cannot hear each other. Yeah. And to my mind, very little will be gained. Just a war. A battle. That being said, the research also shows us even by talking about group dynamics, we ignite the defense. Yeah. So just as we sort of begin to get into this, I'm acutely aware that many males, even those that, if we now pull in that term, this toxic masculinity term that's being thrown around, even those that would not be categorized in any way, shape, or form in that group, may very well feel the defensiveness and feel attacked just by the mention of it.
And so that may become even more acute.
Indeed.
If you were to start singing Gillette.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is quite literally part of that mechanism. We saw such a backlash in defense of that ad. And then from both sides, basically a war erupted. This is what group dynamics does. So I want to first off say to the listeners, try and be conscious of this. Try and understand that the goal, my goal for today, is to try and paint a picture that can be heard. And if it is to be locked in and pulled by this group dynamic, classically we see it will not hear.
I mean, I agree with you, of course, as you know. Hopefully what's also productive about the love affair that you and I have on radio is that we have overlapping consensus around that as a description. Mm. A powerful and important description that you should take into your activism.
Indeed.
About the reality that you are in versus the one that you wish you were in. But of course, I'm going to come back, no doubt, several times in this conversation, as with the psychology of racism.
Indeed.
With where do we hold people accountable for their agentive power as individual members of the groups?
Yes.
And not mollycoddle the fact that they feel triggered by the mere mention of the conversation. We need to do better. So we're going to get there, but that's maybe 20 minutes down the line.
Beautiful.
I totally agree with your starting point. You know, we talk about toxic masculinity, but maybe it's also good to just definitionally check in on masculinity itself.
So, clinically speaking, the term toxic masculinity is not actually a clinical term. It's to my mind, I will say it's almost become a bit of a movement and a term given to certain behaviors. There's, to my mind, no strictly speaking textbook definition. So allow me to lay out what I perceive the clinical description of it can be termed as. If I'm to look at what I've observed from the toxic masculinity movement, the Gillette ad, things like this that fit in, essentially what is being highlighted is elements of interaction or behavior that are typically labeled as male being doing it, but certain types of them are being singled out and labeled as toxic. And I think that is the most important cornerstone to begin this type of discussion, because sometimes the defense comes and the push comes that all male behavior, in fact, the identity of masculinity, the identity of what a male is and what his needs are and what his drives are, is now painted with the same brush. And if it is fought in a war and the group dynamic comes into it, it runs the risk of that happening. But in strictly speaking, if I observe the detail, I will say there's certainly a stark difference. There's certain types of behavior that would be considered quote-unquote toxic.
Well, I think we need to unpack what those behaviors are before we get into both the psychology and then the moral psychology involved here.
Yeah.
You find yourself with a physical body that you didn't choose at birth.
Mm.
That is your sex. You are, on the basis of sex, assumed to have a gender that maps onto it.
Indeed.
Which you don't choose, but because you have a penis, you are assumed to be someone who is also of a gender that goes with having a penis.
Indeed.
And masculinity, in my mind, and I'm speaking here just as a philosophy student, not as a psychologist, is just the cluster of traits that come with certain kinds of embodiment. And it's a weird interplay between biology and what society almost forces onto you and say, Hayden, from birth, you will behave in the following kind of way. So physical stuff happens to you. Your voice starts breaking when you're a teenager. You become a bit more muscular. You are taller than people who are biologically deemed to be female and to be, in gender terms, to be deemed to be women, and we expect you to not cry, to not show emotion.
Yes.
And so there's an entire template for what it means to be masculine and to be a male in the world, and certain kind of behaviors that are then normatively expected of you.
Yes.
And the toxicity, as I understand it, comes in where a subset of what is expected of you in terms of socialization has got quite literally toxic consequences for yourself and your relationship with other men and your relationship with people who are not deemed to be men or male.
That is beautifully put. I don't think I could put it better. That is absolutely, I'm in full agreement. And if we zoom in a little bit, and I want to really urge the focus on this, what the interactions, what the behaviors are that we can then say toxic. And as you've beautifully placed it, actually we can shift it to the level of impact. When it has a certain impact on the receiving end, the behaviors, the impact on us, the impact on others, so on and so forth. And in that regard, if I observe the detail, I will say there's really two umbrellas that we can term quote-unquote as toxic. I say quote-unquote because technically speaking toxic is not a clinical term.
Yes.
But yes.
Yeah.
I will say when an individual is expressing their needs in a way that is pressurizing or manipulative, but the receiving end has very little choice whether to follow or not. then I will put that under the umbrella of toxic.
Absolutely.
Perhaps an example, obviously off the top of our head we can think of very extreme examples, but let us even make it a bit more subtle. An example that I've even observed and heard of, if we are talking about, let's say a group of adults are having a braai, two couples, and the one couple has an adult daughter as well. And the first couple without the daughter, the husband starts to have a few drinks, and then he starts to tell the adult daughter of the other couple, come sit next to him, come sit on his lap. And he pressurizes, no, come sit here. There we can see he has a need. We can hypothesize it's sexual or closeness. We don't know. Let us put that aside. We will be hypothesizing the need. But essentially he is trying to fulfill his need, and he's starting to use pressure. Let's assume the adult daughter says, no, I don't want to. She's feeling uncomfortable for whatever reason. If he continues to pressurize and using social norms, using some sort of guilt, oh, how can you leave me like this, anything, moment that pressure comes into it,
absolutely,
her ability to say no begins to become hampered. What we find, if we look at the receiving end, very often a female in this example will say yes and sit because the impact of sitting next to and that discomfort to her mind may subjectively appear as less impactful than the social backlash of not doing it.
Absolutely.
There, I will say, crosses that realm. Rather, if in fact even, not pause, to pull all the way through, if we were to eliminate the quote-unquote toxicity of it, it would become an invite. If he were to invite her to sit there and she had equal opportunity to decline the invitation or not, there, that is still in line with a masculine need, let us say.
Yes.
But it stops, all of a sudden the behavior is not destructive on
That's
the receiving
right.
end.
702 and Cape Talk.
Family Matters.
27 minutes before noon, we're in conversation with clinical psychologist Hayden Nipps, and we're talking about the psychology of toxic masculinity. It's an opportunity to learn and to grow. If you have some questions, please do give us a call. If you want to share your own stories, please do so, your own reflections. And if you have questions that are also just aimed at disagreeing with us, you're more than welcome to do that as well. 011-883-0702, that's the number here in Joburg. Cape Tonians, you can take part in the conversation on 021-446-0567. Probably the most extreme expression of masculinity that is toxic is intimate partner violence, whether we talk rape or even femicide. The lens of unfulfilled needs, does it also help us to understand those kinds of expressions of toxic masculinity? I'm wondering, because it's a very useful framework, not just as a heuristic device, but as a genuine psychological account of what happens in me psychologically when I behave a certain way around the braai. Does it also explain the other things on the spectrum or in the full range of toxic masculinities?
I will say it is certainly going to play a crucial role. There are some, when we're talking about intimate partner violence, rapes, these types of stuff, the variable of control plays a very, very important role. But it is true, the control is trying to assert one's needs rather than express them and negotiate. So there is a lot there that I agree with you, the golden thread really does pull through. You will find some extreme cases, or let me not even say extreme, you will find, depending on the individual cases, there are distinct differences. So I am hesitant to paint it entirely with the same brush. But if I look at from an overview, that expression of needs is so key. It is absolutely crucial here. It is when there is an awareness that the need is being expressed in a pressurizing or manipulative, whether the pressure becomes physical overpowerment or whether the pressure becomes savvy interaction to corner an individual, but when the element of real choice is limited, here we are walking on very dangerous grounds. When I say dangerous grounds, the toxicity we're referring to here, and I want to just highlight this. On the receiving end, if a male is doing this, he may succeed in fulfilling his needs temporarily. Classically, what we find with manipulation is it is a bit short-sighted. In the long term, the needs start to break down. If you wish to, for example, have a relationship with an individual, you can pressurize them for a while, but over time it will break down. And all that being said, and here's where I want to really tip the focus, is on the receiving end, in our example that we gave, what we will see is quite a high level of discomfort. The example we gave, we had the adult daughter sitting, forced, pressurized to sit next to the friend of her parents' husband. She will probably begin to feel anxious around this individual. Yeah. She will probably change her clothing around him to try and feel less appealing. Now all of a sudden we have somebody that feels uncomfortable, feels scared. She may create distance from her family around events that he's there. The ripple effect becomes quite large from something that is seemingly innocent or seemingly subtle and really not that big a deal. But in fact, I will caution individuals out there, specifically males, to really reflect a little bit in that regard. Hmm.
Leslie, good morning. Thank you so much for calling in today.
Thanks. Hi. I do a lot of work in the area of domestic violence. I'm an attorney, and I have ended up in that sort of work quite often. Hmm. And I don't find this idea of toxic masculinity helpful in that context at all. I think we need to understand domestic violence differently. We need to understand domestic violence as something that happens between two parties who are intimate, their most intimate relationship. And men commit domestic violence, in my experience, and 20 years of it, for a very wide range of reasons. So you've got, on the one hand, Mr. Sociopath, who's a sociopath in most of his dealings with the world, and sociopathy, psychopathy, are psychological constructs which we're starting to get an idea of and might be genetic and so forth. And then we've got people who, for various reasons and very often, are raised where they simply don't have the emotional tools to deal with their most basic needs. So when something is refused them, or in circumstances where they are having to be vulnerable, they will react with violence to stimuli which they should be able to manage emotionally, but they can't. So what I'm saying is, when we attach toxicity to masculinity as a gender, for me that's deeply problematic. I don't, if we think that women don't bully, and women don't sexually manipulate, and women don't commit acts of emotional and physical violence, then we are lying. We are misleading ourselves grossly. All you have to do is go to high school. A group of women together is the most bullying, violent, unpleasant group of individuals in the world. They're just slightly less physically violent.
Leslie, can I just engage in a couple of things? With my 39 years of experience of enjoying the benefits that come with an accidental penis, I don't agree with you, and I'll tell you where we do agree, which is maybe a linguistic difference rather than a deep difference, and then where we actually disagree. I mean, firstly, just on a logical point, we're talking about toxic masculinity today. On this show, we have often spoken awkwardly about how many women are friends of patriarchy. So this conversation is not a conversation that deliberately tries to render women innocent. Whether we talk about the role of, I don't know, the white woman in propping up racism because she spends most of her day with the kids, possibly, and their first lessons about white supremacy comes from mom. Whether we talk about black women and them telling children to shut up when they say, I've been raped by dad or by stepdad or Uncle Eusebius. Of course, there's a conversation to be had about how women, not all women, are innocent, and many women are friends of patriarchy and also have toxicity in their own different kinds of femininity. So the whataboutism, I think we need to guard against. This conversation is not in a... Hold on for one second. I'll give you space. This conversation is not a conversation that exonerates all women. Similarly, I'm waiting for the first male to call in and say hashtag not all men. Because apparently when you talk about what is typical in the world, you can't do so until you have first given Hayden the order of the Baobab for being an exceptional man. So we're talking here about what is prominent and prevalent in terms of patterns. But maybe the word toxic, if it doesn't work for you, I want to suggest something else. Professor Kopano Ratele, who is a psychologist academic who specializes on this topic, has written the most beautiful book that I think all lawyers that work within the legal system would benefit from, because the law is not the most helpful framework for dealing with questions of gender. And he has written a book entitled Liberating Masculinities. And one of the points that he makes is that there are different kinds of masculinities. There's working class masculinities, there is middle class masculinities, there is masculinity attached to what it means to be a white Afrikaner male in this country, white Englishman. And that if you want to do a full, if you want to do, just, no, you can't. Let me just give you the full thought. If you want to do a full taxonomy of masculinity, we'll be here until the cows come home. And maybe a more useful notion is the notion of unproductive or harmful masculinities, if the word toxic is a trigger.
And what I'm saying to you is, you know, when I'm understanding domestic violence, the most horrendous case, the most physically abused woman I ever had, was a woman whose face was so badly broken that her eye socket was destroyed and she lost the vision in that eye. That man was an upper class golf course designer who was as white as the driven snow. So I'm under no illusion, and I absolutely cannot support a concept of masculinity as being attached to class or race. I've just spent the morning in court for a middle-class black man who's a great mom to his child. You know, I don't... My experience of masculinity is not about putting it into little boxes and saying, well, you behave like this and you behave like that. So, you know, given that I represent a lot of fathers in family law matters, I really do find that masculinity has changed tremendously in the last 20 years. Thanks very much. I do agree that there are some constructs where we need to look at why men believe that masculinity doesn't allow them to express their feelings, why, you know, masculinity is described as you can't cry, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not saying that there isn't some useful discussion to be had around there. What I am saying, and this is the only point I'm making, is that it's not useful to understand domestic violence through that lens.
I want to bring our psychologist in here, because domestic violence is a legal concept. I would go further than you and say that the law is not a very useful discipline through which to deal with the psychological and the sociological realities of harmful masculinities. If you want to solve the rape crisis and the domestic violence crisis, you're not going to find a helpful answer in the court of law. The court of law in this country is a very blunt adversarial mechanism for quick justice at best when it helps women and survivors of domestic violence. But I love legal processes, Leslie, but you will know better than me as an attorney the limits of the law to try and deal with harmful masculinities.
I do, but I think, you know, when we talk about fixing these things, and of course as an attorney I do tend to think about the practical rather than, you know, the psychological, because I can't fix people's psychology, but I can make someone, I can take a woman and I can put her in a place where she's not going to get beaten up. That's what I can do. And that's what the law can do, and that's what society can do. And what we can't necessarily do is change how that man has already constructed his masculinity. But it is really fantastic that sociologically we're starting to undefine masculinity by way of those toxic concepts. So we're starting to say, no, masculinity isn't defined in this way anymore. So if that's how you, John, define it for yourself, well, that's a problem, because we as society are not going to put up that mirror and say that's okay.
Okay. Hayden, how do you respond to this conversation between Leslie? Thanks for calling in, between Leslie and myself.
No, I think that there's so many different elements of value here on many different logical levels. But I'd like to bring it in back to the punctuation that's being put on the table. I think I'm going to assume Leslie's attention to highlight on domestic violence compared to toxic masculinity. And it really goes in line with what we were saying moments ago. That it is true we can have elements of it, but it is not in every case. Well, strictly speaking, the way that it's being punctuated. Mm. Or perhaps it overarcs different concepts that will hold a bit more weight. She mentioned psychopathy, sociopath. sociopathy. There we are talking about a very unique clinical personality traits or personality construct or structure. That is really something I would caution to paint with the same brush. And as I mentioned before, I would also go with looking at each case individually. And I understand that if we allow ourselves to mix logical levels or bring in different punctuations, as you pointed out, we can look at different pockets, how women behave in this context, so on and so forth. But to juxtapose that as a reason to not look at this concept from this punctuation, I think you run the risk of losing something there. So if we do bring it back to focusing from the lens of toxic masculinity, as it were, in that instance, she did highlight something that perhaps is of a lot of importance there as well. She was talking about an inability for males to express their needs. Mm. We refer to that as well as their role repertoire, your ability to display different roles, different behaviors, and deal with your environment in that way. There is really to the heart of this. If individuals are only taught to express their needs through pressure, they will have a limited role repertoire, and they will be quite stuck when they become aware that it is doing damage.
Okay, let's take a break there because I want to tackle another area where I disagree with Leslie. Leslie contrasted the work she does as a lawyer, and I wasn't trying to impugn law, by the way. Some of my best friends are lawyers. But she contrasted the nature of her work. She said, I can get a woman to a place of safety. I don't think that's the interaction of many women with the law. But that aside, even if it's true, psychology, certainly as Hayden presents it to us on radio, is not some theoretical, intellectual, masturbating exercise. The bottom line is that psychology can be instrumentalized to change the ways in which we raise boys and to rethink our own masculinities as men who were raised in very harmful ways. And towards the end there, I almost heard a kind of biological essence being assumed about masculinity on the part of Leslie. And I want to ask Hayden, as a clinical psychologist, can the template of masculinity with which we have raised boys and that was used to raise us into adulthood as men who are now adults, can we undo that, and what would that look like?
702 and Cape Talk.
Family Matters.
So there are different parts to the psychology of this kind of harmful masculinities, and there's a element of it that you want to drill down into before we challenge different parts of the population.
Beautiful. Yes, in fact, we can perhaps dovetail it from your question before the break where you were saying is there that typical male template, if we oversimplify it, essentially it is strong, it is unemotional, lack of vulnerability, this type of umbrella term. In regard to that, we're really looking at the male role that is taught. And this brings me to what I will term the second general picture of what I observe in this description of behavior that could be considered toxic, or let's abandon that word, destructive behaviors. And that is really lying in the role. When an individual assumes a role, so let us say another example. CEO of a company is sitting in a meeting with a high-level female manager and a very low-level male employee. And the secretary or whoever is not there on that particular day in that meeting, and the CEO, the male CEO, instructs the high-level female employee to go and make the coffee. Here, her level of employment is a lot higher than the other male employee, but in this context, the CEO is assuming a typically female role to serve. Now, there we can do some damage. So if roles are assumed and placed on individuals, I will term that again under this same umbrella. Okay. So the pressure and the assumption of roles. I want to be very clear. The role in themselves will not create damage. If it is willingly participated in, I have seen numerous individuals in a traditional marriage, male and female, where the male takes on what would be described as the traditional role, the female takes on what would be described as the traditional female role, but they both like that role, and they are very happy. It is when one does not want to be in that role, or in a context is in a different role, and that role is assumed. Mm-hmm. There we run the risk of doing some damage.
So what's the challenge to get us to healthier psychologists? Is it partly to expand and reduce and rethink the role repertoires?
Absolutely, part of it is rethinking those role repertoires, but I will even start as a step before that. We need the first element, if one is to achieve behavior change in this regard, it is to first have a little, start to crack the shell and introduce a bit more empathy.
Okay.
There I will put a challenge, actually, to the male listeners out there that are hearing this. I want to challenge you to approach a woman in your life. Probably everyone has some woman in their life, or at least close to, a mom, a colleague, a partner, a friend, anything. Try and ask her as an individual. Let's take all of this group off the table. As an individual, ask her, has she ever been in a position from a male where she felt pressured to do something, where she felt belittled, humiliated a little bit, simply because, and she felt it was because of her yeah. gender. In that regard, my challenge is to hear her. Ask her what it felt like. What actually happened? How was it? Ask her as much as she can recant the details.
And you know what's interesting about this challenge?
Yes.
Is that in itself, it requires an expansion of the role repertoire of men.
Indeed.
Because one of the harmful aspects of many masculinities that we are settled with as men is to know it all. So even as you ask mom or girlfriend or female colleague, woman colleague, for their experiences, you are still tempted, because of the way you've been socialized,
yes,
to interrupt their expertise with your confidence.
Indeed. And you are pointing out a hidden logical level that I was hoping would slip by in the challenge.
Okay. And you've also got a challenge for women who are listening to this conversation.
Yeah, just as a final thought for the male one, it is to then ask yourself, is that the impact I want to have?
Sure.
Do I want to have that impact? Because what they report is what the impact is. Okay, then for the females, yeah, it comes a bit different. It really does require just a touch on what you were putting on the table earlier, philosophically or morally. When do we forgive or when do we fight?
Sure.
With the difference between groups. Clinically speaking, and certainly we can thrash this out at a later stage given time, but clinically speaking, if two groups are opposed to each other, you fight when you wish to win, when you wish to squash the other group. If you wish equality, you cannot fight, because you will not gain equality through a war. You will gain superiority through a war. So my challenge to the woman, and please bear with me, I wish I had more time to thrash that out. My challenge is, when you are impacted by something that makes you feel humiliated, frustrated, and you feel it is because of your role as a female, instead of challenging the male on a group level, instead of saying this is toxic masculinity, something like this, challenge on an individual level. Express your need clearly. State to the individual as a human being that you feel humiliated. And request, can we rather do it differently? Or I don't feel comfortable in this role as an individual.
Okay, I'm not going to challenge you. I'm just listening. Hayden, thanks so much for coming on today. And where does all of this stuff and some of your other work now live digitally? Pretoria Psychology, is that your new website?
It is www.pretoriapsychologist.com.
Fantastic.